Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. I'm Norman Sade. I'm a professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University, where I head the Mobile Commerce Lab. And I'm also a visiting professor at Hong Kong University, where I've been coming for 2 weeks each year for the past 6 years. It's a pleasure to be here. And today what I'd like to do is I'd like to share with you some of the work that we've been doing in my lab in the context of mobile and social networking. Over the past few years, I've come here each year and I've talked about different topics. Last year, I talked about mobile security and privacy. Today, we're going to look at a very different side of mobile and social networking. We're going to be looking at what can be done with all these data that's being created and how it can be put to hopefully good use in the process. So my plan for this evening is to talk about effectively leveraging the wisdom of crowds, as it's referred to, in general, looking at how we can combine all the data that's being generated these days in very large volumes by cell phone owners in particular, combining that with machine learning, data mining techniques, and trying to look at different domains where this can be applied. The focus of my lecture this evening will be on understanding the dynamics of cities, but time permitting, I'd like to at least talk about one other domain where we've been playing with similar types of techniques, and that has to do with the quality of apps in mobile app stores, which is another one of those very interesting domains where there's an awful lot of data these days, and people have a very hard time keeping up with all these applications that are popping up. Some of them are potentially very dangerous. Malicious apps have popped up over the past few years, and they've infected millions of cell phones in the process. And so we're going to look at how we might be able to use different types of techniques also within this domain to potentially empower mobile app store operators to potentially clean up these apps before they create problems. So to perhaps introduce this presentation, I'd like to start with a few very casual questions. Some of them are perhaps a bit more appropriate for the U.S. population, but hopefully you'll be able to relate to them. So how many of you have ever wondered where people who attend a football game, for instance, and obviously you've got different sports here that you're following, but how many people who attend a football game where they came from or where they go after the game? Right, so is this a question that sometimes you wonder about? Well, it might be if you're, for instance, interested in selling things to these people, then you might be interested in finding out where they're likely to be found later, perhaps in the evening. Where people come from when they come to the mall on Saturday afternoon, where were they in the morning? So if you're interested, for instance, in advertising or promoting some products, you would like to find out where they were earlier, perhaps to give them promotions, coupons, and things of that nature. So that's sort of the marketing side of things. But there are also all sorts of other types of problems that would benefit from a deeper understanding of the cities and where populations are to be found at different points in time, different days of the week, different times of the day. This might have something to do, for instance, with public health. If you're worried about the spread of viruses like the flu, for instance, and you know about a particular person who's been infected, you might want to ask yourself, how do I contain this best? Where is this person, the people who've been in contact with this person, most likely to be found? Who do I potentially give a vaccine to, right? Who are the people that I need to monitor first? And obviously, beyond that, you've got all sorts of other problems that have to do with urban planning, right? So, for instance, the construction of new highway, right? People argue about all sorts of different projects, and a lot of these arguments tend to be very subjective in nature. It would be nice if somehow we had data that could essentially inform these types of conversations in a slightly more objective manner. And the list is long. I'm going to stop here. So what are people in a given area of town doing at a particular point in time, particular day of the week? There are some neighborhoods where it's very tough to tell, but there are some neighborhoods where it's pretty easy to tell, right? So, you know, if you're on this floor in this building here, there's a good chance that you're attending a lecture, right? And if you're perhaps a floor down, there's a good chance you might be shopping or having dinner, right? And so those are the kinds of things that we can certainly tell. And, you know, thinking about public transportation, we're talking about that just a few minutes ago. Understanding where people are, where they're going to go, might help you, for instance, modulate the schedule of buses and other types of other parts of your public transportation system. So people have been pondering these sorts of problems for many years, but often they've lacked the data to really reach meaningful conclusions. In the United States, for instance, people have been busy collecting data on a very large scale every 10 years in the context of something known as the census, right? And the census is a very massive effort, and you find census processes being enacted in countries all around the world. I'm sure you've got similar types of processes here in Hong Kong as well. These are very massive types of efforts, in particular because the resulting data is being used for a variety of decisions, right? So, for instance, people will be allocating seats in Congress based on how many people are found in different parts of a state, for instance. Right? People will be making decisions about budget allocations for different kinds of projects. So counting people correctly is a very big deal, and there are always issues as to whether data you've collected has potentially been skewed, because perhaps some people tend to be less responsive than others. In particular, minorities, people who perhaps, have lower incomes. Those are the people that historically have also proven to be more difficult to reach and receive responses from. And it's for that reason in particular that all these beautiful maps that you can access, for instance, if you connect to the Census Bureau's website in the United States, and these maps are very rich, they contain a lot of information, but these maps have also been the result of massive, massive processes. So, for instance, the last census in the United States involved 600,000 workers and cost $13 billion. That's not exactly a cheap proposition. And you look at all these data, and at the end of the day, even though it's extremely rich, it's not terribly helpful when it comes to answering the kinds of questions that I mentioned earlier. It's not very helpful because effectively it gives you a static snapshot of, what the situation was like at the particular point in time, but doesn't really tell you how things are changing on an hourly basis, or even on a daily basis, for that matter. And so it's, even though it's very rich and can certainly help address a number of problems, it's also limited when it comes to addressing the more dynamic types of questions that I tried to illustrate earlier this evening. And so there are other kinds of maps, on the other hand, that people have been talking about for many years. And these maps are much more subjective in nature, but they can help inform the kinds of questions that I outlined earlier. And so these maps were introduced in particular by urban planners, in particular Kevin Lynch in 1960 introduced this concept of mental maps. So what are those mental maps? Mental maps are the ways in which we as individuals relate to the environment around us within the city. This is, if I say, for instance, restaurant, each one of you will be thinking about a different place. If I say restaurant on Sunday, there will be a few places that will potentially come to mind or not, right? If I say movie, Friday night, different movie theaters might come to mind. If I say, something like going shopping for groceries, you might think of different places. If I say, how do you go from point A to point B, even how you got, here from work, let's say, different mental maps will basically pop up in your heads. And for some of us who've got similar types of interests, perhaps similar types of habits, these mental maps might be very similar. And for others, we might find that their mental maps are not of much value to us. So someone who's got very different interests, very different types of habits, lives in a different part of the city, they may have lots of mental maps too, but their mental maps may not necessarily may not necessarily inform me in any sort of meaningful manner, because effectively I'm not very likely to have similar types of interest. So these mental maps are very subjective, right? They're going to be different for different people, but these mental maps collectively also tell us a lot about the activities of people within a city. The kinds of places that come to mind, those places that come to mind as you've got, different objectives, as you try to engage in different activities, will eventually dictate the kinds of things that you do and where you're likely to be found at different points in time. Right? So if there's a restaurant that opens up, not too far from where you live, but you don't know about that restaurant is not part of your mental map, then it's not very likely that you're going to be found at that restaurant. Right? Someone might tell you about the restaurant, and then it might become part of your mental map, but until you know about it, you're not going to be found there, right? So collectively, These mental maps can be thought of as the collective wisdom of people. These mental maps evolve over time, and they're the result of our experience as we engage in different activities, as we go around the city. So you might go to a restaurant and you might absolutely hate the food, and that restaurant will not make it to your mental map, or it's going to make it into a very negative category in your mental map. It's going to be like, let's try to avoid that place at all costs, and let's definitely not recommend this to anyone, right? And so this is what we're talking about. And obviously, this information, if you could somehow aggregate it, would provide you with a lot of insight into the fabric of a city. What are the kinds of activities that you're likely to find people engaged in at different points in time, in different parts of the city? This is effectively a reflection of all these mental maps that each one of us has developed over time. And so, obviously, the question is, that sounds great, you know, now you've told us how we can answer all these questions that we were talking about earlier, right? So, you know, where do people go after the football game on Sunday? Well, that's going to be in part dictated by, you know, what their mental map suggests that they do after the football game. And so, you know, all I need to do is access those mental maps. The only problem is these mental maps are not in a database today, right? So, you know, marketers would love to, you know, say, well, where is the API? Give me the API and I'll start, you know, sending coupons based on these mental maps. The problem is these mental maps are not readily available, right? And so how do we collect these mental maps? Well, traditionally the way we've been collecting these mental maps has been sort of a very, you know, has involved very tedious processes. Effectively, we've been, you know, some people, urbanists, for instance, have been spending, you know, countless hours observing, essentially, people. So you would sit at a corner, or you'd follow people, or perhaps you'd go and you'd ask them questions. That's not a highly scalable process, right? So this is something that I might be able to do in a given neighborhood, right? I might be able to do this for a short period of time, but that's not something that I'm going to be able to scale. That's not something that's going to help me answer the kinds of questions that I've outlined earlier on a large scale, right? Certainly not for a place, for instance, where I've never been, you know, where I've never been able to send people and those kinds of things. But the world is changing, right? So the world is changing because effectively now we have sites like Foursquare and other sites that effectively, you know, are enticing people to check in, as it's called, right? So checking in. Why do people check in, and what is a check-in? Well, a check-in is basically reporting that you're at a given place at a particular point in time. So why do people check in? Variety of reasons, right? Some people like to show off. They just want to tell their friends, hey, I'm at this really cool place. You know, aren't you impressed? Other people are hoping to get coupons, right? So they're going to check in, and they're going to hope to become the mayor of, you know, the Starbucks, so that maybe they can get a bit of a discount the next time they buy a coffee, right? Whatever the reason for checking in, these check-ins provide us with glimpses into the mental maps of people, right? So effectively, these mental maps these days might potentially be easier to collect than they've ever been. We don't actually need to follow these people. These people report back to us through these check-ins about some of their activities, not everything. You're not going to find too many people checking in at, you know, AA meetings, alcoholic anonymous meetings, right? You're not going to find too many people checking in jail and those kinds of things. But there are lots of other places where people seem to be, and by the way, people do check in at these meetings. We've been collecting this data on a large scale, but you don't find too many of those check-ins. And you would hope that somehow these were mistakes. But nevertheless, this is effectively a new phenomenon. And the question is, you know, with all this data now that's being created, do we potentially have the ability to finally collect this sort of data much more cheaply than we've ever been able to do in the past, effectively at a fraction of the cost that people who've been involved in efforts such as the census, right, and also in a manner that would enable us to answer questions that are much finer in terms of temporal granularity, much finer in terms of capturing the dynamics of cities and what's going on in the cities as you sort of look at things over time. So could social media help? And so this is a question that we asked about 2 years ago. We've been in this space for a while. My group, for instance, was among the very first groups to develop location sharing applications. We did this over 10 years ago. We've developed and deployed probably four or five different location sharing applications over the years. We never went commercial, but we certainly had tens of thousands of downloads over the years. But Foursquare clearly is well beyond that in terms of scale. And so Foursquare was a much more natural sort of environment to look at. So Foursquare today claims to have somewhere between 25 and 30 million users. It continues to grow. As of December of last year, 2012, they already had something like 2.5 billion check-ins. That's a meaningful amount of data, and certainly something that you can start playing with. So when you look at these check-ins, some of them are public. In fact, the vast majority of these check-ins are public, so they do not come with any privacy restrictions. It's basically, here's my data, and you know, I'm happy for the world, presumably, to see it. And so we decided to run an experiment where we collected 18 million of those check-ins and tried to see what we could do, tried to see effectively to what extent we might be able to use this sort of data to answer the kinds of questions that I sort of introduced at the beginning of this presentation here. And so this work that I'll be talking about was actually published about a year ago, but I'll also talk about more recent work that we've been doing. And ever since we've published this work, we've been flooded actually with requests. So every day I continue to get requests from pretty much all around the world, including lots of requests that make absolutely no sense, like people saying, you know, can you help us better understand, you know, the nature of communities in Africa using this data? And my response to that is, I'd love to, but there aren't too many Foursquare users there, as far as I know. But hopefully one day, and there might potentially be other ways of getting the same data. And obviously a lot of more meaningful requests as well, and some collaborations have emerged in that context as well. So let's take a step back and sort of think for a minute about what this data really captures, right? So check-in data, as it turns out, is associated with different venues. So each venue will effectively be a particular place where people have been checking in over time. And at this venue, you're going to find a collection of people that have checked in at different points in time, right? So a venue can be thought of as, I'm going to be using a little bit of mathematical terminology, but hopefully I'm not going to get anyone lost. Very simple concept. You can think of it as being a vector, right, with the length of that vector being the size of your population, right, and each entry in that vector being the number of times people have checked in, right? And so some individuals will be checking in here multiple times, and the vast majority of people in your population will never check in at this place because that's, you know, that's the way the world is. It's not like, you know, everyone around the world goes and visits the Starbucks next to your place, right? So that would create a bit of chaos. So every venue obviously has a unique fingerprint that effectively defines the mix of people that you're likely to find there, right? And different venues have, you know, different mixes of people. Some venues will be very close to one another in terms of the people you're going to find there, and other venues will be somewhat more distant, right? And we can effectively start analyzing this data by looking at these fingerprints to try and better understand effectively what are the neighborhoods that are most likely to capture the activities of different people, and what sorts of neighborhoods do you find different people in during the course of the day, during the course of a week. We are creatures of habits. When you look at location data for people, it is surprisingly boring. And I've been doing this for many years now, and others have done the same thing. It is surprisingly boring. You find that people spend more than 90% of their time at about three places, right? One is home, right? One is work, and there's typically a third place where people spend a tinier fraction of their time, something like perhaps 5% of their time on average. And then beyond that, depending on how boring these people are, right, you might find another 5 or 10 places. But that's pretty much it. Most of the time, you know, that's where you're going to find people. It doesn't mean that you're not moving between these places, but if you're looking at places where people stay for 10 or 15 minutes at least, that's what you find. So we're creatures of habits. And so effectively, taking that into account, you can find out about the areas where people are most likely to be found, and that will effectively define individuals, and also individuals through their check-ins are effectively defining the nature of different places within the city. They're effectively defining neighborhoods in a very organic manner. And that was one of the first questions that we wanted to look into. We wanted to see to what extent we could redefine the notion of neighborhood. Moving away from the traditional boundaries, right, every city has this notion of neighborhoods that, you know, for all I know, date back to 100 years ago, if not longer, because one day someone decided that this was the way the city was organized. So here in Hong Kong, obviously, you've got Admiralty, and you've got Wan Chai, and you've got Causeway Bay. And, you know, I'm sure that in many ways, these neighborhoods still mean something, but I think we also all realize that the city is in flux. Right, so if you look, for instance, at you know, the Western District, things are changing there. Right, you're seeing new buildings popping up, and so what these neighborhoods meant, you know, 10, 20 years ago, may no longer necessarily reflect the reality today. But these check-ins are obviously much more in line. They're sort of a snapshot of what's going on today, and it might tell you something that you would not be able to see, for instance, in data, such as the data collected by the census, which is much more static in nature and which is confined by these predefined boundaries that I was talking about. So what have we done? Well, effectively, we've said, like I mentioned, that each one of these venues is defined by a mix of people, is characterized by a mix of people. And you can start thinking about also ways of comparing these venues and measuring the distance between these venues by looking at not just geographical distance between these venues, but also social distance, the social distance being defined by the differences in the mix of people you're going to find at these venues. And as you start measuring these things, and I'm not going to bore you with the math here, but this is actually fairly simple math, as it turns out. As you start measuring these distances, you're going to find that some venues, even though they're geographically very close, are fairly far apart in terms of the mix of people you're going to find there. And other venues seem to be much more closely correlated in terms of the mix of people that you find there. And so as you build this graph, where effectively each edge node is going to be characterized by how close the vertices that it connects are to one another based on both geographical and social distance, you end up with a pattern that starts looking like that. And so you can say, well, could I somehow identify boundaries just based on effectively this way of building a graph? And the answer is sure, you can. And the kinds of things that you're going to do, and so how do we do that? I'm going to spare you the math that goes behind it, but there are traditional machine learning techniques that can be used. They're called clustering techniques. In this case, we're using something called spectral clustering. We've played with other techniques as well. And as you apply these techniques to a graph like this, very quickly, you start seeing some boundaries that will emerge from this type of analysis. So these boundaries, effectively, will say, well, this is a, you know, a closely connected, somehow nearly a click, if you want, closely connected portion of the graph. Here's another closely connected portion of the graph. But between these, we're finding that the edges are very thin. There's not that much overlap in the social mix of people that you're going to find there. And so we call these neighborhoods that we identify in that manner, we call them lifehoods. We just decided to give them a different name. And we've been doing this using all these data that I mentioned earlier. And as you start doing this sort of analysis, for instance, this is a map of Manhattan, then you end up with these colorful maps that are actually available on the web. So there's a live site that you can connect to. And so this would be a snapshot of Manhattan, for instance. And what you do, or what you see when you look at a map like this, is you recognize many of the neighborhoods that, you know, people would expect to see when they look at Manhattan. So you're going to recognize, you know, for instance, places like Times Square here. You're going to find places like Soho, for instance, right? So those are your typical neighborhoods. You're going to find the Financial District, which is a bit lower here. And so by and large, you're seeing things that you would have expected to see. And so if this is all I had done, then you would say, you've really wasted my time here. Thank you very much. All you're doing is you're rebuilding maps, and so we're not really discovering anything new in the process. Well, just hang on for a sec. Right? So the other thing that you can do as you start building those maps is you can start looking at what's going on within each one of these neighborhoods. So because this data comes also with information about the nature of the venue, for instance, is it a restaurant, right? Is it a, you know, is it an office? Is it a nightlife spot? Is it an arts and entertainment spot? When do people come to these places? Right? You end up also with effectively a daily pulse and an hourly pulse, right, for each one of these neighborhoods. But what you can also do is you can look now at how closely correlated these neighborhoods are from one another. So to what extent, what are the five neighborhoods, for instance, that are most closely related to this one? here. In other words, the people that I'm going to find here, where else am I most likely to find them? What are neighborhoods that are most closely related to that? Well, those are the kinds of things that you can also extract from this data. So now, if, for instance, if I focus on this neighborhood here, this is going to tell me that, hey, these other places here are the places where these people go. You don't find them here very much. You don't find them there. Right? Why is that? Well, that's how the data, that's what the data says, right? So if you let the data speak, that's what it tells you. These neighborhoods are not necessarily exactly the kinds of city neighborhoods that you would find. They're actually different, even though we did see things that looked very similar. So here's an example where things start looking more interesting. So what you're seeing here, and this is in Pittsburgh, so I'm sure nobody knows Pittsburgh. I've lived in Pittsburgh for many years, and Pittsburgh is a good place for me to study because I can actually go and talk to people and understand what's going on, and I can look at things. Right. So this is an area in Pittsburgh that's known as the Southside Flats. Doesn't matter. Right. In this area, right, in principle, the traditional maps would tell us that this is just a single neighborhood as defined by this boundary that you're seeing here. Our data says otherwise. Our data suggests that there are four different neighborhoods or livelihoods, right? So livelihood, LH, stands for livelihood 6, 7, 8, and 9, right? So is our data, you know, wrong, or are we capturing something interesting that basically has not been captured, you know, otherwise? And so how do you find out, you know, whether your data is completely off or whether you're actually reading something that's meaningful? Well, the way we've done this is we've gone and we've actually interviewed people, and we've done the kinds of things that urban planners do, but on a small scale, obviously, to say, hey, are we seeing something interesting here, or is it just noise, or is it our algorithms that are just going crazy, right? And so the story behind this neighborhood here is one where, as it turns out, LH9 is actually very clearly a new area. It's an area where you've had new development that has taken place over the past 10 years. This is sort of an open-air mall where you've got major brands that have opened over the past few years. So the typical brands that you're going to find, you know, also here in your major malls are going to be found here too. But this is also a mixed sort of development area where you've got sort of luxury condos, not too different from places that are not too far from this room here. This area, on the other hand, is a very different kind of area. This is an area in particular where you've got lots of bars, right? This is the area where students will tend to hang out on Friday evening and on Saturday. And this area in between is yet another neighborhood. And so when we interviewed people, they confirmed, you know, and we've done this obviously on a fairly in a fairly systematic manner, they've confirmed a variety of different things. So for instance, they confirmed that what we're capturing could be correlated even with issues of safety, for instance. So this is a quote from one of the many people we interviewed. They said, well, whenever I was living down on 15th Street, so this is actually referring to this area, right? So this is towards downtown, so the street numbers go down in that direction as you move west. Whenever I was living on 15th Street, LH7, I had to worry about drunk people following me home. But on 23rd Street, which is basically in this area here, I need, so these are quotes, so forgive me for the English, this is just transcribed, you know, as people speak. I need to worry about people trying to mug you. So it's different, right? So it's not something I had anticipated, but there's a distinct difference between these two areas on the south side, right? So this is something that somehow our data is picking up. A different person comparing these neighborhoods said something like, from an urban standpoint, it's a lot tighter on the western part once you get past 17th Street, right? And here it's a lot, you know, it's much more spread out, right? People clearly identified LH9 as being its own thing, and we have many more of these quotes, and so that seemed to be sort of validating things. But then we had this little neighborhood here, LH6, and I've been living in Pittsburgh for over 20 years, and I had never noticed this neighborhood because I had never been there, right? And so we're sort of curious, what is this thing that our algorithm is picking up? Is it, you know, again, sort of a blip, or is there something else going on there? And so we asked people again, and we tried to find out what was going on. As it turns out, this is a very tiny area where you've got a grocery store. It's called Giant Eagle. It's a chain that's sort of fairly famous if you're in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and that I'm sure you've never heard of. It's a grocery chain. And there are a few other stores around it that are intended to sort of appeal to the crowd that goes to that supermarket. Right. And so when we ask people, here are the kinds of things that they told us. They said, well, you know, when you look at LH6, there is this interesting mix of people there. You don't see them walking around the neighborhood. I think they're coming to the Giant Eagle, that's the name of that supermarket, and they come from lower-income neighborhoods. I always assume that they came from up the hill, mysterious reference. So what do they mean by that? Well, as it turns out, you've got, you know, these poor neighborhoods that are sort of up the hill. So if you go back, you know, here you notice that there's a river, and so, you know, you've got a hill basically going up in this direction here. So the people who are living up this hill, as is very typical in neighborhoods where you've got lower incomes, they're not well served in terms of supermarkets. So there is nothing, nobody, you know, people didn't see much of a return on investment in building a supermarket right in their neighborhood, and so they ended up building one here. And so these people come there. How do we know that? Well, we know that because effectively when we're looking for the next most closely livelihood, that's what we find. So it tells us that the livelihood that's most closely related to this one is actually this one right here. And so those are the kinds of things that this analysis is actually able to pick up. And so that's obviously fairly encouraging. So when you look at these things, we've mapped out the number of cities now. You can actually access them online. So we've had lots of feedback from people, including cities that we don't necessarily know very much about, but we sort of essentially crowdsourced, again, feedback from people. And occasionally there were a few things that were not correct. But most of the time, it seemed that we're really capturing things that were going well beyond the typical boundaries that you would find on maps, and that really captured people's perception of what was going on the ground. The kinds of things that the locals would know, but the kinds of things that you would never know unless you were a local yourself, right? So in other words, you know, for instance, if I'm an urban planner, or let's say that I'm a developer, developers are very excited about this stuff. If you're a developer, right, and you're trying to figure where your next project is going to be, or if you're in charge of opening stores for a retail chain, where do I open the next restaurant? Where do I open the next store? You're constantly doing this sort of analysis. You're trying to figure what is the right neighborhood to focus on. It's not like you've been spending time in each one of these neighborhoods. I mean, you're trying to look at this from a high-level perspective before you zoom in and try to get more data in one particular neighborhood. Well, these sorts of maps will essentially give you the type of insight that ideally you would want to have, because that's the sort of insight that the local would have, except that you're not the local, you're living in one place and not all the other places. From an urban planning perspective, these maps seem to also be capturing, you know, the more dynamic types of trends that I was talking about. So we found, for instance, neighborhoods that were shifting, where one neighborhood starts spilling into another and vice versa. So this is another example that probably you cannot relate to in Pittsburgh, where you've got these two neighborhoods that traditionally have been very distinct. Shadyside is a well-known sort of yuppie neighborhood, fairly affluent, you know, people tend to live again in luxury condos and those kinds of things. And East Liberty traditionally has been sort of, you know, a poorer sort of neighborhood, lower income types of people. And over the past 10 years, this area has been in flux, in part because a luxury supermarket was actually created, new development was built around it, and all sorts of other things have changed. And those are the kinds of things that, again, you can pick up. Some neighborhoods are splitting, so those are examples of other things that we've picked up. So lots of interesting things are coming out of this analysis. One thing I should say, and this might be hard to believe, so the map that I showed you of Manhattan, for instance, that was produced based on 500,000 check-ins. That's a very small number. The map that we have of Pittsburgh, the kind of analysis that I showed you here with Pittsburgh, where we can actually go down to that level of granularity, that was the result of looking at 40,000 check-ins from 5,000 people. Right. So like I said, we've only collected 18 million check-ins, or we had only collected 18 million check-ins at the time, basically in the United States. And even just with this sort of data, which on the surface seems to be very small, we're actually able to already see these kinds of patterns. And so we found this to be extremely extremely exciting. Now, Foursquare data is limited, right? So it's clearly skewed, right? When we're talking about those 25 million users, they're not going to match the demographic of, you know, the population at large. This is changing over time, but, you know, I don't see you know, my grandmother becoming a Foursquare user anytime soon. So I think we'll never capture her in that data. But what's important to understand is that this sort of analysis is not necessarily restricted to Foursquare data. Foursquare data was just readily available, so we decided to basically use it and see what we could do with it. So you've got tons of other sources of location information. I mean, think about, you know, credit card transactions, right? That's a check-in, effectively, right? Think about, you know, people boarding the bus. I mean, there are tons of different ways in which you can actually collect location information these days. It's actually very creepy, if you ask me. But if you use this data for good purposes, and certainly it is being collected, if you're using this for good purpose, subject to, obviously, privacy restrictions that are associated with it, this is the sort of analysis that you would be able to do. Right, so we've tried to go beyond this, and we've, over the past year, asked ourselves to what extent we can also come up with finer types of fingerprints for different types of neighborhoods, effectively using information that's attached to each one of these venues. So these venues, for instance, in the case of Foursquare, are annotated with information about the kinds of businesses that you're going to find there and all these types of things. And so we've been asking ourselves to what extent you could come up with a typology of city where you would effectively identify different types of canonical neighborhoods, right? And not just within the context of one city, but actually also looking across cities. So can we find effectively, you know, what is the typical fingerprint, for instance, of a university neighborhood? Not a campus, but a university neighborhood. That means also all the shops and businesses and restaurants and all sorts of other things that you're likely to find in the vicinity of that campus, but not on campus itself. Can we find, you know, the fingerprint of, for instance, you know, neighborhoods where people will hang out on Friday night? Can we find fingerprints of stores where people are going to go shopping on Saturday? Those are the kinds of questions that we're interested in doing. And so to do that, and, you know, I'm not going to bore you with lots of technical details here, but we've relied on techniques that have traditionally been used to analyze language. So over the past few years, you know, with Twitter and Facebook and all these other phenomena, people working in natural language processing have been playing with techniques that are typically referred to as topic modeling techniques. Effectively, what you do is you try to identify in an organic manner collections of words that are actually associated with different kinds of topics. And then look at these words, and you manually actually determine what is the most likely topic that this collection of words corresponds to. As it turns out, you can actually do the same sort of analysis for venues. And so we did that. This is just a map. You're not supposed to be able to read this. It's just a map where effectively we've been able to identify topics such as, you know, rail travel. So, you know, what are the neighborhoods around rail stations, for instance? Medical areas. So what are the types of neighborhoods around hospitals? Air travel, shopping, university, coastal areas. So this is, you know, what you're going to find typically around, you know, along the beach, outdoors types of areas. Koreatown, so that's much more specific, right? So what does Koreatown look like? Chinatown, sporting events. This is for the U.S. right now. And as it turns out, you find that there is essentially for each one of these neighborhoods, there's a unique mix of venues that you're going to find, right? So for instance, you're not going to find a Chinatown in the United States that doesn't have a bunch of stores that, you know, sell ingredients for Chinese food. You're just not going to. So that's unique, right? And if you find this together with a few other things, effectively you can say there's a very high likelihood that what I'm looking at right now is, you know, Chinatown in New York City or Chinatown in San Francisco. And so those are the kinds of things that we're talking about. Right? And so when you do that, and this is work that has not been published yet, although it should be, it's in the process of being accepted for a conference where we present in September. When you do that, so for instance, if you're looking at college neighborhoods, you end up with maps that look like this. So this is actually the area around Columbia in New York. This is Los Angeles. So what are the university neighborhoods in Los Angeles? We're going to find USC, University of Southern California. Does anyone know which one this is? I don't know if you can see from distance, UCLA, right? So this would be Westwood, right? And then you've got a bunch of others. One of those is probably JPL, not even a try, Caltech, yes. So those are the ones that you find. This is, you know, so can we find, for instance, the places, the shopping areas in New York City? right? And so this is what you find when you're looking for those fingerprints. So here you've got, you know, I don't know how well you know Manhattan. You've got Soho, Nolita, right? So north of Little Italy, Union Square, Madison Square, Harold Square, Meatpacking District. You might say, Meatpacking District, what do you mean? So if you don't know New York, the Meatpacking District is no longer the Meatpacking District. It's a neighborhood where you've got lots of trendy brands, you know, and all sorts of fancy stores that have actually opened over the past 10 years. This is where Google also opened its new office building. It's actually the second largest building in the United States that they've purchased. So that's sort of what we're talking about. So we've had a good amount of press coverage for this. I'm looking at the clock here just to see how much time I have. And obviously there's a lot more work that needs to be done. We've started to work with different organizations in this space. We're actually very surprised by sort of the variety of organizations interested in leveraging this kind of work. You find that many people have been looking for this sort of data. They realize, you know, whatever decisions they're involved in, they've sort of relied on fairly objective data, but very static in nature. And they've always felt that they were missing that sort of social layer, essentially, when it came to finding information that could inform decisions. And so we're doing obviously a good amount of work in this area. The possibilities, as we can tell, are fairly broad, from urban planning to transportation, real estate, personal recommendations, travel and tourism, public health, public safety, obviously marketing, hard to avoid, and those are the kinds of things that we're looking at today. But if I have time, and I think I do, perhaps I can tell you about at least another domain. So we're doing this sort of analysis across different domains. I decided I would pick at least one other domain just to perhaps briefly illustrate, you know, how things can work in very different areas. So this is a different project called WISCOM, and WISCOM is a fairly new project that we launched not even a year ago at this point. This is going to be presented also at a conference in Chicago this coming August, known as KDD. So this is sort of the data mining conference. And what we've tried to do here is we've tried to essentially see how we might be able to help app stores. One of the big problems with app stores is that they've, you know, competed to have as many apps as possible. You know, those of you in my class, and I see a few of you here, know that effectively Apple was the first one to launch an app store back in March of 2008, and then eventually Google said, well, we're going to be in that space too, and they launched their app store. But they were behind when they launched, and obviously they had to catch up, and they created a model that was intended primarily to entice developers to come to them. So they sort of, you know, basically dropped, you know, all sorts of obstacles to make it easy for developers to just write code, publish these apps. There was no, and still today, there's minimal vetting of apps being posted on these app stores, right? The name of the game has been to be able to claim as many apps as possible. So the app store today claims to have 775,000 apps, and Google is not too far behind, and I think they've actually stopped counting, to tell the truth. And so the problem with these app stores, right, is that the original model is one where basically, and so this economy is obviously growing very fast, right? So again, those of you in my class who are here, you've seen this chart before, right? This economy is growing extremely fast. We're looking at about $20 billion, which is quite sizable for a market that didn't exist 5 years ago, right? Quite sizable. But also, it's a market that effectively reflects a need that was not addressed before, right? So effectively, if you think about the App Store, apps existed before Steve Jobs invented the App Store, but nobody downloaded these apps, right? So we had, for instance, J2ME cell phones, Java-enabled cell phones, since 2001. So people were able to write apps that would run on cell phones. Nobody would download these apps, number one, because they didn't know how to. Number two, because if you wanted to pay for an app, you had to give your credit card information to some random people you had never heard of, right? And the App Store solved that. It solved that by saying, do not worry, we're going to be collecting payment on behalf of these people. The only people you need to give your credit card information to is us being Apple, for instance. And we're going to take care of the rest. You don't need to worry about giving your credit card information to two random guys in a garage, or for all we know, you know, people who are going to be stealing your credit card credentials. And so the success of the App Store, right, is in great part based on the fact that they address this fundamental trust issue that people had. But trust remains a fundamental part of their recipe, And that part is no longer really there, as it turns out, because they've been competing so hard to get all these apps that they actually forgot to worry about the quality of these apps. Right? And so when you look at an app store today, you've got tons of malware, as it turns out, especially on the Android app stores, but also even on the iOS app store, as it turns out. But beyond malware, right, and malware hopefully will get caught relatively quickly, but it might hurt people. There's been examples where millions of people have been infected with malware before it was taken down. But you also have lots of apps that are just of very poor quality, right? Apps that will crash your phone. Who wants to download an app that's going to crash their phone? Nobody, right? Apps that will drain their battery or abuse their privacy, right? Who wants that, right? Apps that will basically waste your money, right? You're going to spend $2-3 for something, and then you're going to say, my goodness, this is complete junk, or waste your time, or, you know, some other things. So effectively, you know, for these app stores to continue to be able to sort of have this special relationship with a customer, they need to actually go back to their fundamental reason for being, which has a lot to do with trust. And they've got to actually say, okay, well, you know, that competition based on the number of apps we have, you know, that's the past now. I mean, by and large, we've got enough apps to, you know, people are buying these smartphones in droves, so that's no longer an issue, right? The app stores have succeeded as far as creating a lot of content for people. The next step is to go back to saying, we've got to make sure that we're known for as a place that offers quality content. And so Apple has taken that view from the beginning, in truth, right? But Google now is also taking that view. The question is, how do they do that? And the question we've asked is, you know, could we somehow build technology that would help these app stores automatically identify apps that have problems? So how do app stores vet apps today? Well, they do that, you know, in the case of both Android and Apple, it's a combination of some software that will be scanning, you know, these apps for malware. It's also a combination of trying to get these apps to run for a few minutes and observing that nothing really bad seems to be happening. And then if these apps pass the test, they're, you know, considered to be good and they get posted. But users who actually use these apps, right, for more than 5 minutes, they'll see things that the software that, for instance, Android runs will never see, because Android will be running this software for about 5 minutes. So can we somehow leverage comments that will be entering by all these users to essentially find out whether an app is good or not? And could we potentially enable these app stores to even take down some apps before they create more damage, before users, you know, is there any point, if I've got 100 users that are already saying that an app is really bad, you know, should I wait for another 10,000 to download the app? Or should I potentially take it down until the developers come up with something new, right? And how about potentially helping users before they pay the $2 or the $3 or the $1 or what have you? You know, could I potentially help them understand what it is that they're going to download so they can make a better informed decision? So those are the questions that we've been trying to answer. And so from a natural language perspective, there are a variety of different people who've been looking, for instance, at trying to analyze product recommendations on Amazon, trying to understand whether, you know, people like a camera or, you know, they like a movie or what have you. Most of those comments that you find, you know, tend to have a lot of text with them, and so they're relatively easy to analyze from a natural language perspective. The problem with comments on apps is they tend to be much shorter. Most of these comments are written from cell phones. They have many more typos, right? People use slang, ill-structured sentences. So it's much more challenging in that regard, as it turns out. So the type of processing that you need to do, and without going into lots of details, actually has to go beyond the kinds of things that people have been doing traditionally in that space. And so our goal here, or our motivation, has been to, number one, see whether we could potentially empower app stores, right, to automatically identify problem apps and make decisions. You know, maybe this app should be taken down. It's not like any app that has bad reviews should be taken down. That's not what we're talking about. And so, as I'm going to show you, what we want to do is we want to also understand, why are these users complaining, right? The users might be complaining that, hey, I wish I hadn't paid $2 for this app because really I think it's worth $1. That could be a source of complaint, but that's probably not enough to take down the app. On the other hand, a user might, you know, a bunch of users might say, this app is crashing my phone. This is very annoying. Or this app drained my battery in about an hour. Right, I really do not recommend it. Those are examples of apps that you would want to probably take down. These are also the kinds of things that you would probably want to convey to developers, right? So A developer can review five apps, can look at 5 or 10 reviews, but if you've got 1,000 reviews, how do you make sense out of all that, right? Just looking at a score doesn't do it, as it turns out. And so those are the kinds of things that we're interested in doing. And so we've been looking at essentially at trying to analyze these comments at three different levels. One is at the level of individual reviews. Why are we looking at individual reviews? Well, we're looking at individual reviews because we're interested in being able to calibrate what people are saying. It's very funny. I'm going to show you the stats in a minute. The average score for the average score that's given as part of reviews by users, you know, who've played with the apps, is 3.9. That's the average score on a scale of 1 to 5. So most apps, you know, look good on paper. By and large. Obviously, there's some standard deviation. There are apps that get very poor ratings. But a 3.9 really doesn't tell you an awful lot, right? And so we've been trying to see to what extent you can get a finer understanding of what's going on by looking at these individual reviews and looking at the text behind these reviews beyond just the score. We've also been trying to understand how apps evolve over time. I'm going to show you what the typical lifetime, the typical life cycle of an app is. Essentially, these apps, they get modified, new releases go out, and people do this on a very regular basis. Very often, when something new gets released, it's actually pretty bad initially, and then it gets fixed, right? And so you want to be able to keep up with that life cycle as best as you can. And then at a high level, you can even find out what are the kinds of things that people care about for different categories of apps. So do people care about the same things when they download a game as when they download, you know, another kind of app? There are actually some interesting differences that come out for this type of analysis. So I'll try to go relatively quickly so that we stay within schedule. So we've looked, for instance, in this case, at something like 170,000 Android apps and 13 million reviews about these apps. Some of these apps are free apps, which is typical on Android, but some of them are also paid for, paying apps. And when you look at these scores, as I said, lots of people are very generous in their scoring, right? So the majority of these ratings are fives, as it turns out. I was actually very surprised initially. I thought a lot more people would be complaining. I mean, the complaints are the ones that typically, you know, you read about in the headlines, like, you know, Facebook just released an app and it's terrible, or those are the kinds of things that will make the headlines. But when you look at this at a more detailed level, you find that there are lots of fives. So the average is about here, 3.9, right? And then people are also very binary, right, in there. So they're going to say something. If something is really cool and great, they're likely to write something about it. And if something, you know, is terrible, right, they're going to use various expletives and let you know that they're not very happy about that app. And then in between, you find a lot less stuff. People are not terribly nuanced, as it turns out. And so we've been playing, you know, with apps, trying to sample things in a meaningful manner, looking at all the different categories of apps. You've got 30 different categories of apps on the Android market. And when you look at these things at a more detailed level, you know, tons of apps have like 5 reviews or fewer, and then you've got, you know, this heavy tail here where basically, you know, there are apps that have thousands and thousands and thousands of reviews, right? And those are the apps that matter the most, because obviously those are the apps also that get downloaded the most. That's very closely correlated. So some of the analysis that we've done has been basically to see to what extent we can associate different kinds of words in these comments with either negative or positive, evaluations of an app, right? And we're also interested in seeing to what extent you're going to find reviews where the score given by someone to an app is inconsistent with actually the comments that they've written. There's an interesting percentage. It's not huge, but something like 1% of the reviews are actually completely inconsistent. Someone will write something great and give a 1, or something will write something terrible and give a 5. Right? So clearly you want to remove those things because, you know, something wrong, you know, was going on in that case. So I'm going to sort of skip the technical stuff here. So this is actually using relatively simple stuff. There's some math behind this. This is actually the simple part of the math. This is linear regression. So it's effectively about trying to come up with weights that you're going to associate with all these different words so as to come up with the best possible match between effectively whether a given word is viewed as being positive or negative and the ratings that you've collected, you know, from all these people who've written reviews about the apps. And so when you do these things, things, you find that some words, you know, have a very positive weight and some words have a very negative weight, right? So the most positive word that we've identified is actually misspelled. It's awesome without an E. But fortunately enough, you know, awesome with an E is also pretty good. And then in between you've got excellent, right? And go figure why fault, you know, with 0.61 is up there too, but it is. And amazing, fortunately enough, is also in that category.
Now, shouldn't you have corrected the awesome? It was a misspelled. You should have added the two together.
Well,
and give it a much heavier weight.
Give it a much heavier weight. So, you know, if it's awesome or awesome, we would have to correct every one of those things, and there are lots of typos in these things.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, what you want to do when you do this sort of analysis, you want to deal with the reality of things. This is what people write, you know, and there are strange words, you know, I don't see anyone here. I mean, all those are probably in the dictionary here, although, you know, here's one, right? That's not in your typical dictionary. But clearly, you know, that's one that matters a lot. I mean, this is, you know, from large-scale analysis. So you got to just, you know, deal with what, you know, people use.
Cool doesn't appear on this. The word cool.
Cool, well, you'd probably have to go a bit lower, but, you know, cool, we use cool, but the younger crowd somehow, you know, they're past that. So nowadays it's more like awesome without an E. That's what they use. Say that again?
I think we would spell it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Because we would spell it the right way.
So, you know, this is, I mean, this is very rich. This is very rich data. It tells you so much more. You know, there's probably room for an additional analysis about, you know, the kinds of things that people mistype or misspell. And here are the negative words, and I'm sure you can sort of see why they would fall in that category. Right. And so, when, oops. Don't worry, I've had this before. It's very recoverable in principle. Here we go. Right. So what's most interesting, however, is that beyond just these weights and trying to see whether something is negative or positive, what we've been able to do is we've been able to go one level lower than that, one level deeper. As it turns out, some of these words mean more than, you know, negative. They convey more than just negative sentiment. They actually tell you about, you know, the kinds of problems that users have encountered. So, for instance, you know, things like crashes or spam or bloatware or misleading, those are essentially hints, right, about the nature of the user's frustration, right? Slow, confusing, expensive, permission, privacy. Those are things that actually go to a level deeper than what I've just outlined earlier. And so we've tried to see to what extent we could actually build collections of words that would correspond to different categories of problems, effectively trying to diagnose the nature of the problem based on the comments that users had written, right? And by the way, this is the percentage I was talking about. So 0.9% of reviews have ratings that are inconsistent with what they say. So clearly you want to remove that stuff, you know, when you do this sort of analysis. So can we do this, you know, can we find effectively a taxonomy of problems that people are most likely to be complaining about? And the answer is yes. When you do, again, this sort of topic modeling work that I described earlier, where you find collections of words that correspond to different kinds of problems, you find, you know, that you've got issues of stability, you've got issues of compatibility, issues of connectivity, issues of cost, right, issues of spam. So you find actually these categories in an organic manner. Right? This is emerging from just looking at these kinds of comments. And so what I can do now is I can use these topic models that I've identified through this analysis, and I can effectively, in real time, right, look at comments that people are entering about an app, and I can effectively diagnose the nature of the problem associated with this app. So this is an example of, you know, a very popular app, Plants and Zombies. I don't know how many of you have played with that. I don't, but you know, it's certainly very popular. And this is also very typical of that life cycle I was talking about. So when you look at reviews, which is basically what you have here, number of comments entered, you know, over time. So these are, you know, different dates. So this is looking almost at a whole year here. You find that when a new release, you know, hits the market, you know, people tend to respond very quickly. A number of people download the app, a number of people enter new reviews, and typically these reviews are negative for a while, and then, you know, eventually things sort of cool down, and then, you know, the problems get fixed typically, and then it gets pretty quiet until there's a new release, right? And that's what you find. And so notice the negative ratings and the positive ratings, right? So notice that typically you've got a big spike here in negative ratings. Problem gets fixed, and now people are happy, and they send positive ratings. Right? So you can really see what's going on, right? Just based on this analysis, as it turns out. So this is sort of what you can do. You can effectively see, you know, when things were released, when there were problems, but also you can tell what the nature of the problem was, right? So I can actually look at I can build pie charts, if you want, of comments that people are entering, and I can see, for instance, that initially this was a stability problem here that we're dealing with, right? And then eventually that got fixed, right? And then they came up with a new release, and that new release, the nature of a problem was actually more like a connectivity problem, than certainly earlier. And then eventually that got fixed too, right? So those are the kinds of things that you can start seeing when you do this sort of analysis. So if you're an app store, and I'm not saying that this is a fully solved problem, again, this is sort of early work in this area, but certainly lots of interest from these companies operating app stores today in trying to see whether they can take this to the next level. Effectively, the idea is that these app stores have become so large that you cannot, you know, hire people. Apple or Google cannot hire people just to manually be looking at all these even all these reviews to try and make sense out of all these. Instead, automate it, right? It's actually very easy to do that. And you can almost see in real time what's going on. You can really sense the pulse of your user population and how they're responding to the release of these new apps as new versions, you know, come up. And so the final level of analysis that we're interested in doing, and this is going to be the end of my talk here, was to sort of see what are the kinds of things that people care about when you look at different categories of apps. Again, you're not supposed to read all these things. I'll just tell you what you're supposed to see at a high level. And so what we found when we looked at the top three complaints for different categories of apps is we found that, for instance, for games, and so this is labeled by one of my PhD students, he decided to call this attractiveness. I'm not sure this was the best selection, but effectively, you know, this is, you know, how cool the app is, if you want. Stability seems to be a number two issue, and cost is sort of a number three issue. But when you look at different categories, you find that, for instance, for books and reference, accuracy would be a top consideration. Issues about the ability to use your phone at the same time as you look at the reference. Issues of connection. Right, those are the kinds of complaints that people have with those kinds of apps. And so this is where I'm going to stop. This is an example of how you can visualize these things. So here you've got free apps, and here you've got paid apps. Look, for instance, at the paid apps. I decided to distinguish between A, which stands for application, and G, which stands for games, looking at the top three sources of concern that users express. So unattractive, okay, again, not necessarily the best selection of words, but essentially, you know, this app is not cool, costly, and unstable. And when you look at paid apps, you find that when it comes to apps that are non-game apps, the biggest issue is actually cost. So all the A's are really sort of in that corner. That's what seems to be mattering the most. But when you're looking at games, you find that you've got G's a bit all over the place. And so people for games seem to be a bit less cost-sensitive, as it turns out. So that might tell you something as a developer. How do you want to position your app? What are the kinds of considerations that matter the most? So to sort of conclude this presentation, right, so I've tried to sort of show you how in different domains we've been able to use the wisdom of the crowds, and on the one hand to try to better understand the dynamics of cities, what people are doing, what different neighborhoods, you know, will tend to correspond to in terms of activities, but also where people come from and go to. And in terms of apps, I've shown you how in an entirely different environment, some of the very same types of techniques with some adaptation can also be used potentially by an app store to identify problem apps and restore this notion of trust that seems to be so fundamental for app stores to continue to do well. And so that's in a nutshell what I wanted to talk about this evening. I hope you enjoyed my presentation.